Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag, and we're going to get started today. I'm going to issue a correction. Oh. My Nyko. Remember, we were talking about this. Mm-hmm. I had the inconsistent performance problems, so I'm tearing apart my my media system in my living room the other night, and I pulled the Nyko off, and I set it down, and I'm looking at my Kinect, and it has an asset tag on it. It was some of the beta hardware from the beta from Kinect, and they gave out afterwards, they said, just go ahead and keep your hardware. So I put a different
Everything
Kinect.
Will be fine.
So I put my other Kinect on there, and it works fine. So it must just be something with that device. Maybe I dropped it, or maybe it's just some finicky hardware, but anyway, my Nyko works. I'm thrilled. So
it's possible that they did change the optics slightly between the beta and the final revision.
It was early on, so that's why they call it beta hardware.
Exactly. It's not meant to be perfect.
Yeah. All right. So first question from Brian. I rightly fear for the durability of the single 160 gig SSD primary system drive on my 64-bit Windows 7. Ultimate Edition box. I'm kicking around the idea of buying 2 to 3 smaller SSDs and rebuilding my box with hardware RAID. My gigabit board has a built-in RAID controller due to driver changes and complexities around that darn hidden system partition. I've assumed that I'll need to bite the bullet and pave and start over, but I'd really love it if there's a simpler way to preserve what I've got without having to reinstall any ideas. So, yeah, we were peeling grapes about this earlier, and we just said...
It's a lot easier just to pave and rebuild. I mean, if you do a
it's
complete...
It's possible.
It is possible.
But easier if you just flatten.
Well, you're incurring the risk of screwing something up and then not able to recover at all.
Yeah.
Any of your system. I mean, going with his particular scenario, he's running it on one SSD right now, and he wants to go RAID. That's a lot different than, say, just swapping out for a bigger hard drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the whole boot process for Windows. It's very specific.
Yeah.
And it's very specifically different when you have RAID involved. Because when you have RAID involved, you have your hardware RAID controller, which means it's an entirely different driver when Windows boots in order to see that controller. So the ideal thing is to, of course, back up your system, which kind of brings to the point that he had, is he's not entirely sure about his 160 gig SSD. He should always be keeping backups regardless.
Yeah.
And it actually is, like, nowadays it's so much simpler just to do a reinstall of Windows. He really should just bite the bullet, back up the data, and reinstall from scratch with the right drivers, the right up-to-date drivers. You can do some fiddling with, you know, setting your system up to appear as if it was booted off a RAID drive, then sysprep it in order to deal with, you know, activation style issues, because Windows will notice a hardware difference. Injecting drivers, resetting your BIOS into HCI mode or into RAID mode, depending on how it's used.
I think any time you're injecting your PC with anything, it's just time to repave. But that's...
It's cleaner.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it tends to be a lot cleaner. I like clean installs. I really do.
Yeah, same here. So possible, but probably not best practice.
Yeah, I'll definitely say that it's possible to do it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Windows, pretty much anything is possible.
Yeah, but save yourself some headaches and just
yep.
take the easier way out. All right, good one. All right, thanks, Brian. Next question. I'm building a system with 24 gig of RAM. Can I just get rid of the page file? Why does Windows still need a page file if I have that much RAM?
So this goes back to, you know, the entire architecture of Windows, right? Back in NT days, when, you know, Windows NT was first being developed, nobody had 24 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah, you know, a little rare.
Nobody had gigabytes of RAM,
yeah.
really, in order to do any meaningful testing on. The entire point of virtual memory is so that applications can ask for memory. Windows will make it appear as if they have it, but when it's not actually being used, they can swap out to disk.
Mm-hmm.
My friend, Mark Rusinovich, whom I respect incredibly greatly, has put out basically a treatise on the Windows memory model. His blog of Pushing the Limits of Windows, he talks about all the different types of limits that we have, you know, virtual memory, physical memory, page pool memory, handles, processes objects. He just goes into this very deep dive of why the limits are the way that they are, you know, why things are not infinite, and why when you get an error message of you're low on resources and it says that you have a ton of memory, why is there that discontinuity there? Anyways, I could talk about this particular blog, the section that Mark has done, for like 3 or 4 hours easily.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to recommend people go read it.
It's very detailed.
It's very detailed. So go read it, take a break, go read it like half a dozen times, and you might actually get a gist of it because it is complex.
And then go read it again.
Slowly. Going back to the original question about, you know, 24 gigs of RAM, do I still need a page file? Yes, you still need a page file. However, Windows recommended page file size of 1.5 times your physical RAM. You're probably not going to need that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not really going to need 36 gigs of memory, or of a page file. So what you can do is, as I've mentioned in the past about monitoring your machine, run all of your applications that you'd ever want to run at one time. Look at the commit charge of all of that together in Task Manager. That is basically what your page file is going to be. Now bump that up by another gigabyte to give yourself some room.
Or two or three.
But, you know, you're probably looking at, if you're using all of your software, all of your games, you're probably going to run one game at a time. You're not going to run all of them at the same time.
Yeah.
But you'd probably get away with an 8-gig page file, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But Windows itself still requires it. It's core to its entire reason for being, which is why even if you disable it, Windows will create a very small page file. Guaranteed, it will always be there.
Yeah.
You can never completely get rid of
it. It is in the DNA, so you're not getting rid of it.
You're not getting rid of it.
Okay.
It is really just a misconception that if you have, you know, all of this RAM, why do you still need the page file? You won't use the page file as often. But Windows itself will say, look, you know, if this particular piece of memory isn't being used, or the contents in this memory isn't being used very much, let me swap it out to disk and say, you know, more useful stuff can go into that spot, right? So it's just, it's a place to keep unused or least used data.
Yeah.
And even if you have 24 gig of RAM, you're still going to be paging out some stuff.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. All right, next question. When I right-click on an image online and select Set as Background Image, where does it save on my computer?
This is...
It's a good question. I always kind of wondered that myself. So you save an image, and...
So you're choosing the Set as Background.
Yeah.
Right? And... Sure.
And now you actually want to keep a copy of that.
Right. That actually exists in your app data folder. Under Microsoft Internet Explorer, right here, this Internet Explorer wallpaper BMP.
Cool. And see, every time you save that, it just overwrites the same file.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So if you want to keep a backup of this, you know, save that off.
Copy that to your pictures directory or something.
Exactly.
Nice. Awesome. Okay, next question. I have a folder filled with many images, and it would be handy to get a list of all the tags that are used. So when I'm adding new images, I can reference that list and make sure I don't have new tags, miss a tag that would be applicable. Is there a way to do this? So, yeah, we were talking about this earlier, and you could do PowerShell script to do this.
There is a website that I found for tags. This is specifically meta tags for media, movies, sound files, but the same effect for picture files.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to actually visually show you what the tags were.
Yeah.
And how you can just use Explorer to figure out quickly what tags are being used. If you go into Details view, the tags toolbar may or may not show up, but you just right-click and, you know, select tags. And I've tagged some picture files, image 7 with foo, War Hero Bar, and then you notice that I have another foo picture file. So
we have a file that's named foo and a tag named foo.
Right. So if I just went to go and search pictures, and if I typed in foo, I would get two pictures. But there's this great little addition called tags.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to just find tags that had foo in it, or pictures with tags that had foo in it,
mm-hmm.
you could find the single image that had that. And if you wanted to get a quick listing from your pictures, what tags were there, you can just sort your tags.
Yeah, just click on the header that says tags, and it's going to sort by those, and you can scroll down and see what ones were used there.
Exactly. Or, as we were talking about earlier, you can go and write a PowerShell script, and that'll go and find all the tags, do, you know, a num instance. If it's one, then you'd save it off to a file,
mm-hmm.
and then you don't have to... you'll just get a nice list of all of the tags, and you won't get duplicates if you just want a master list of tags.
Cool. Okay. There you have it. All right. Is there a way to set up shortcuts to easily switch between having two monitors extended or duplicated? Perhaps a PowerShell script that would set it... That's a good idea. A PowerShell script that would set it from one to another PowerShell script. It would set to another setting. My motivation, so I'm working alone, I want the monitors set to extended and be able to use them both efficiently, but sometimes when collaborating or displaying something that is convenient, have display monitors duplicated. Since I go back and forth frequently, I'd like a shortcut to make the change rather than going through screen resolution menu in Windows 7 every time. I got good news for you. You don't have to write a PowerShell script. It's called Windows P.
Yeah.
So you do Windows P, and there it all is for you. So you don't have to go into the screen resolution stuff. So simple. Just save you a little bit of time there. All right, next question. I have a program pinned to the taskbar. After upgrading the program, the icon broke. Now what I get is what you see below, and they sent a little screenshot. The ugly default icon, application icon thing. If I unpin it, I get the correct icon. If I right-click on it, the icon breaks again. If I pin it again, still the broken icon. How can I fix this?
I've actually seen this one before, which is unlike many of the weird problems that come up. Or it's like I just haven't seen that one. That one I've seen.
Yeah.
It's a problem in the updater. Now, what you can do is go to the original file location of the .exe, rename the .exe. Run it, pin it, unpin it, go back, rename it back to the original .exe.
So it's a simple little process.
It's a simple little process. It's a problem with the icon cache, right?
Yeah.
So it's the thing that we pinned looks like something that's not there anymore.
Yeah.
So we can't find the right icon.
And renaming it will fix that.
Renaming it will fix it.
Okay. All right. So that's simple enough. All right, next question. I'm going to build my next gaming system, a quad-core i7-960 with 16 gig of RAM, DDR3 RAM, and 2B-determined SSD. I don't care about the load time of Windows 7. It can take as long as it wants. I'll do something else. I'm thinking about... I'm thinking I put the SSD disk only for my games and some programs I install in C program files. My theory is that once Windows is loaded, all the vital parts are already in memory, and having an SSD for the Windows partition will not speed up things significantly after it's loaded. I also intend to redirect the temp file, temp directory to the SSD disk. Any thoughts? Is there a better way to get the most out of your SSD for gaming? He expects to have 2 terabyte of other just, you know, physical disk space too, so not just the SSD.
Right. What size did he say the SSD was?
I think 160.
160. I mean, setting that aside for games is actually not a bad idea, because mm-hmm. if you have a lot of games that are loading resources, loading maps, pictures, movies, cutscenes, whatever, you know, reading it off the SSD is going to be faster than reading it off rotational.
Of course. Now, we were talking about this before, and for a lot of the games I guess I've been playing lately, like Call of Duty, you know, I'm not... I was trying to think, where would an SSD benefit that game, because I'm not noticing a lot of loading anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But you were talking about if you have other games, like let's say Flight Sim X,
sure.
or some games that have movies that play cutscenes and stuff like that, if you see a load bar in your game, that's probably a good indication that SSD would speed that up.
Right. My particular recommendation for this is, sure, I mean, if you want to use the SSD for games, that's fine. It's a smaller drive anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But I would personally RAID his OS drive with a RAID 0 for rotational, so at least he doesn't completely miss out on getting speed from the OS side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, once things are in memory for the OS, they don't tend to benefit too much, but why not just benefit from having a RAID system for your OS drive?
Yeah.
And again, you know, for OS drives, RAID 0 is fine, because You know, you just back that up. I never care about if the OS drive gets trashed because, yeah. again, it's a reinstall, big deal. 20 minutes of my life is worth it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question. In Windows Explorer, when I click on a drive that happens to be my CD, DVD drive, I get the message, please insert a disk into the drive, which might be okay. But then the DVD drive opens and I have to close it. I consider this very rude and I do not like it. Is there a way to keep the DVD drive from opening when it's empty and Windows tries to access it? So first off, you said I can't repro this.
Well, I couldn't repro that.
You couldn't. I could.
And yeah, because you click on the drive differently.
Yeah.
Or you click differently.
Well, open up Explorer here first, and let's talk about this. So typically the DVD drive doesn't show up here, and I think this might be where they're talking about, because if you're talking about clicking on that, you have to double-click on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tested a machine in there.
Mine would be okay with a double-click if I hadn't turned on single-clicking.
Yeah, that's true. So it pops out your tray. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I can see how that can be kind of annoying. I know in my home system, I've got my home PC rack mounted, and the door on the rack is closed. And so the drive will try to come out and just sit and bang on that door. And what I typically do, I mean, one thing you can do, I don't think there's a way to prevent this from happening because there's a logical reason for it.
Well, I have not delved into whether or not there's a group policy to disable this particular effect.
Mm-hmm.
There may very well be. But it, generally speaking, if you're clicking on the DVD drive, right, you want to do something with it.
Yeah.
You want it to open. Or if you have a bunch of CD or DVD drives in your system, you may not know which one is which all the time.
Yeah.
Right? But if you had, say, a DVD writer, a CD reader, and you wanted to write something,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, that tells you right up front which one is the writer. So if you double-click on it, then you can see which drive pops out. And it's kind of a better indication as opposed to the very light silk screen that that you get on DVD drives nowadays where you can't even tell what it is.
Yeah. And in my instance, I have the drive showing up on the left pane. And that happens by going into the tools folder options and doing show all folders, which will show your drives on the left pane whether they've got anything in them or not. And so if
Indeed.
You click on that that drive there, it will pop out the tray.
Yep.
I just right click on it and I do close tray, which your drive may or may not have that option on it, whether or not, like that drive, I don't think your tray can probably close because
no.
it's a
The laptop style drives were,
doesn't have the mechanical servo to pull the drive the
exactly.
tray back in.
Right.
So, but on my drive at home, I can do that, so I don't have to get up and walk over to the rack and open the door, pull it out, push it back in.
So, we know that there's a reason for it, and for the majority of users, they tend to like it, assuming that you know they even use media anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I can definitely look to see if there's a group policy that will turn it off.
Yeah.
Or some setting in Windows that will turn that off.
But for the most part, that's just a function of Windows.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question here. Is there a simple way to run every program Windows 7 as an administrator? I want to change something in the host file, but Windows didn't let me until I started Notepad with administrator rights. Then I tried to run FileZilla server on XAMPP, but I was unable to until I started XAMPP in admin mode. I'm tired of running into strange issues related to this. Is there a way to run everything as administrator?
Yes. It's really, really, really not recommended.
Yeah.
We don't do any extensive testing in that mode.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of applications out there that have been written to expect UAC, which is what the Windows 7 and Vista functionality is by setting your admin account in what's known as a protected admin mode, where you do have to elevate in order to run things as a true administrator.
Yeah.
But there's software that's been written that specifically expects that particular mode of Windows and will act differently if you turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, you can turn it off, and you know we have UI for doing it, so um, you can turn it to the never notify, which will turn it off. We really, really do not recommend doing that. If you have issues with it, it's kind of like you're on your own.
Yeah. What's the worst thing that can happen?
Well, if you turn it off, IE does not run in protected mode anymore.
Okay.
Which means that IE runs as an admin, which means all of your add-ins, the websites, everything will run as an administrator.
So don't do this.
So don't do this.
Yeah.
It's really you're just asking to be
owned.
Owned. You know, you're going back to an XP level of security. You're losing a lot of benefits of being in protected mode. Now, for some of the things that he was talking about, where you know you're editing host file. Well, how often are you editing host files?
Yeah.
The thing that I do on my systems is I just keep a command window running as admin. You know, to me, this is where I do my admin work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I want to go edit the host file, I just go Notepad. This notepad is running as administrator. I can now edit the host file, save it, do whatever I need to do. Anything that runs from this elevated CMD will run with elevated privileges. That is a better mode of, in my opinion.
Yeah, it seems like a good alternative.
As a regular home user that wants to do admin stuff frequently, this is, of course, not my absolute preferred mode of doing things. My preferred mode of doing things is actually run as a standard user entirely. And if I want to do real admin stuff, switch over to an admin account, then log out as required. But, you know, for convenience sake, the admin command prompt is very, very useful.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool.
Just don't start IE from it.
Yeah. And why?
Because it will run as admin.
Oh, that's true. And then everything you visit, you're going to be an admin user.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, pick of the week time. First pick of the week, Windows 8 App Store. So we have tipped the hat a little bit and talked about the Windows 8 App Store a little bit more. So you can find out more about this. We'll link to the CNET article. What's a high-level stuff here? A little bit better cut for developers.
Mm-hmm.
So especially after $25,000, you only give up 20% off your app. That's not too bad. Also, the price point for apps in the store will be from $1.49 to $1,000.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You can...
That's pretty cool. That's getting up to, like, you know, Photoshop land.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Hopefully we see, you know, more of the $1.49 apps.
Yeah, I would like to see a lot of $1.49 apps in there. So, yeah, that would be very cool. So,
I really like this model, or, you know, the model that we're taking with the App Store by giving a very streamlined avenue for developers to sell their software in a consistent manner, right?
Yeah.
And it's for all over the world. They get to say, you know, where they want to sell it. The revenue stream is very consistent. It's very streamlined for them. They don't have to worry about placing it on multiple different places and having to worry about all their different transactions.
Yeah, and
we manage all of that.
And it's very nice to see an app store on Windows, finally, because, I mean, that is a very big market for developers, so I'll give them a lot of traction.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, very excited to see this. Can't wait to see what happens. Next pick of the week is my next point-and-shoot camera, the Lytro. This is a very interesting device here, which you're looking at the photo gallery from it, but we'll actually look at the camera here. There you go. It's a little bit bigger than I would have thought it would be.
It doesn't give a scale representation, so
well,
I can actually tell how big it is.
Well, if you go scroll up, and there's a picture of someone holding it, go to the camera there. Try that one. There you go. So about how big it is. So it's a very interesting camera, and you should go in here and read about the science of this and how it actually works. But apparently it takes a very detailed picture, that you can then go into later and adjust some of the parameters, like, you know, the focus. So it shows here, like, you take, try a different picture, one that has a lot of depth of field. So let's say you take this picture and you're like, well, the picture that I wanted to focus on, it was on the person behind it, not on the coffee cup. And so check it out. You can go in and change the depth of field.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. So this is perfect for my wife, who tends to always focus on the wrong thing in pictures. And then complains about the hardware, you know, why does our camera not work right, instead of, like, why didn't I focus on the right thing? So this is a very interesting camera, and I can't wait to try it out, and hopefully this will be my next little point-and-shoot. It's also got a really fast startup time, so, you know, you can get that picture without having to wait for your camera to get ready and things like that. So comes out next year. You can actually pre-order it now. And once I get one of these, we will try it out and we'll see what we think. We'll give a full review on this.
I wonder if it only allows the one particular focal point. Because you know how on a lot of DSLR cameras, you can actually get the entire
field. Yeah, the whole frame. Yeah.
In focus, because each individual lens can, in a motorized mount, can twitch a little bit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like you can adjust.
Yeah, and, you know, if you have one of those cameras, you'd think, well, you could just focus on a section of the picture and blur out everything else. But this really, it can tell what's in the foreground, what's in the background, mm-hmm. because when it blurs different things, you know, it's being very accurate about what's in the foreground, what's in the background. So it's interesting how it does that, and I want to know more.
Yeah, so, it looks like a cool piece of technology.
Can't wait to see this. Interesting. And I'd be interested, too, in what kind of software it comes with to be able to do this after the fact.
Because mm-hmm.
it's not the type of thing that you do in Explorer. You know, you'd probably have to use their software for it.
That would be my guess, yeah. Because you're not manipulating a single JPEG. Not even a RAW file, I don't think, would be able to do this.
Very cool. So we'll check that out. That's the show for this week. If you want to email us, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. You can leave us comments in the show notes. Of course, we like the email for going back and forth. And we'll see you next week.